Hey guys, welcome to the Challenge Podcast. I'm Coach Steve.
And I'm Coach Nick, and we're going to be talking about everything fitness, health, and the challenge.
Let's get on with the show.
What's up guys, Coach Steve here, and welcome back to another episode of the Challenge Weekly Show. Today I'm joined with our co-host, Coach Nick. Nick, how are we doing today?
Very well, thank you, Coach Steve. And yourself?
I'm good. I have a quad pump, so everything in the world is good. It is perfect. It is great right now.
Excellent. Well, I can match that with a shoulder pump and a bit of a back pump. So like between the two of us, we have nearly a complete physique.
We have a complete, maybe like front, maybe like lat spread going right now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
We've got some lats popping, shoulders popping, and some quads. Front lat spread between Coach Nick and I. How good, Nick?
I actually take up more of the screen than you. Like, come on. Well, actually do it properly.
I have mentioned that, Nick, you always seem to out-angle me in every photo shoot. So it's definitely your skill right now to out-angle me in any cameras. But look, Nick, it is episode number 66. Ooh, we're close to the old devil's number. So 66 of the Challenge Weekly Show. So if you enjoy this episode today, go check out the other 65 episodes of the Challenge Weekly Show. Now, Nick, we are in this kind of lull and exciting period in the challenge life. So the Max and Maxine challenge has been running for a good 10, I think 11 years now, depending on how you define it started. And we are transitioning into the new M challenge. So we're in this kind of like lull, exciting period where, you know, the Max and Maxine challenge is being archived, put to the side. And then we're transitioning into this M challenge and launching our brand new M challenge app. And Nick, I know that you've been working so hard behind the scenes, putting the app together. Nick, tell us a little bit about when we can actually get our hands on this app.
Oh, well, we can get our hands on it on the 13th of June. So don't be doing anything else on that day. That's when you can get your hands on it and you can have a look at all our hard work. And yeah, it's very exciting. There'll be heaps available then and heaps more available when prep week starts. So I'm so excited.
Yeah, I'm so keen for this winter challenge, and that's going to be kicking off on the 11th of July. So that's when we're actually kicking off the challenge. Mm-hmm. But you'd be able to download the app from the 13th, and the prep week starts on the 4th of July. So a few key dates. And, you know, Nick, I had a little bit of a moment on the weekend. So I went and saw my mother. I went and saw my mum, and I was showing her behind the scenes of the app. And I said, "Mom, look, I've made it. I'm on an app." So I want to say that when you download the app, you will see Coach Nick and I featured quite a few times on the app, some photos, some videos and other bits and pieces. My mum was not as excited as I was about being making it in my career as being featured on an app. But that's something to expect. You're going to be seeing lots of photos and videos of Coach Nick and I on that M Challenge app.
Yeah, I think you and I are the most impressed, like, just about ourselves. I don't think our families and friends care as much as we do.
I'm the classic. I try to explain to my mum about what I do for a living. I'm like, "Oh, I work online." She's like, "Get a real job, you know."
I think that's what my family thinks as well, except for when I'm working at a weird time and they're like, "Put your phone away." And I'm actually like, I'm working, and they don't understand.
No, that's cool. That's what we love about the job. It's what we love about the M Challenge. It's what we love about the fitness lifestyle, where it is, you know, a little bit all-encompassing, which is a good and a bad thing at times. You know, when we are looking at transforming our body, it's more than just that, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes or an hour that we spend in a gym. It really does encompass the whole 24 hours of the day, which for some people can be quite intimidating, and for others it can be quite fulfilling, because it goes, "Wow, yeah, I'm working for this greater picture, this greater thing that I'm trying to achieve, which takes up, you know, a big portion of my day." And I think that may be a bigger commentary on life as we know it at the moment, where we are kind of chasing lots of instant rewards and, you know, quick fixes for things, whereas when we really want to make significant changes to ourselves, you know, we need to put in the effort, we need to put in the work, and that does take quite some time, especially when most of us want to be resting. That's probably when we should be working.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Nick, We're going to run through this podcast like a little bit of old school Usain Bolt. So the next segment here is we just want to celebrate some of our non-scale victories for the week. But we are putting that non-scale victory segment of this podcast just a little bit on the shelf for now. We're going to celebrate it more once the challenge actually begins. But that doesn't mean that we put it to the side completely, where I think we should all be celebrating our non-scale victories. And, you know, I have one for this week, Nick, and a little bit of a humble brag. You ready?
All right, go.
I went out and bought a new pair of shorts. After our conversation last week, I went to Lululemon and bought a pair of shorts, and I almost ripped them.
Oh, no.
I almost ripped them because I bought them in a shopping center, put them on, feels nice, happy days, go to do my training session. And while I'm training, I'm really focusing on some of those hypertrophy tips that we have spoken about in Coach's Corner, which I'll tell you in a little bit. And as I'm training, you know, I get this really gnarly quad pump, similar to what I have right now. And I got really close to filling out these brand new shorts that I bought. And I'm starting to look at them and they're, you know, getting nice and tight around the thigh seam. So haven't torn them yet, but they're getting close. So that's my non-scale victory, where buying these new shorts, getting a pump, and to a point where I almost fill them out. So that was a nice feeling. And then also spending a little bit of retail therapy on myself was always nice, getting myself some fancy shorts.
Thick thighs save lives.
Thick thighs save lives. You know, I think the life is really about the bottom of the squat. And if you're not getting to the bottom of the squat, you know, you're just missing out.
And if you're not ripping your active wear, then you are missing out as well. As I said, though, you just got to keep squatting. Even if you rip it, just no one cares. Just keep squatting.
You got to keep squatting. You got to finish that set.
Just wear undies.
Nick. Let's run through it. We are now into our coach's corner, mm-hmm. where we're going to offer our tip for the week. So Nick, take us away. What advice do you have for us today?
All right. So with my advice today, I'm going to entitle it, do 600 squat jumps equal 45 cookies. No, like one cookie. I don't know. But basically, is food a transactional item? Can we look at it like it's a transaction? Now, guess what? What we've always said is it's about data and it's about numbers. So of course, if you're diligent, you are going to go, okay, how do I burn off what this particular item says that it is worth in a caloric sense? Why would you not think that? You can absolutely be forgiven for thinking that. And in fact, being aware of your food and what it represents as an energy value is probably one of the first steps to understanding nutrition. However, I have got a few issues with this on so many levels. So I'm going to unleash the Nick beast.
Oh, gosh.
Are you scared?
I'm sitting back in my chair, Nick.
I'm scared of myself. Okay, so once we start equating a caloric burn with an item of food and then an activity, we're getting into really dicey territory. Firstly, let me just say that somebody might then say, my diet didn't work because you are trying to sort of chase your tail and burn off things that you are eating. You're not approaching it in a way where you might be thinking of, rather than taking stuff away, thinking of what can I add to make my experience better. If we keep trying to take things away or make things good or bad, ultimately we're setting ourselves up to fail, and that's unfortunate. You might not do it straight away. You might be able to chase your tail. You might be able to think that you have specifically burnt off something, but it doesn't work like that. Everybody is different. It depends, honestly, 100% on your body weight. It depends on your muscle mass. It depends even on when you've consumed it, what's gone on, how it works in your own body. So there's so many different variables. So when you see those labels, like the posters that say you need to do this to burn this, especially around Easter and Christmas and stuff. I think it's a little bit clickbaity, and I want everybody to be more educated than that. I want you to think of, if you've got your caloric allocation for the day, just say it's being calculated for you, that's your total daily energy expenditure. That's already factored in your exercise. So that's where people go a little bit wrong. And you know what? I love the app that a lot of people use to enter their food. I really do. And I'm not going to say its name, but I'm going to pick on it for something. And what it does is it tells you to eat back your exercise calories. And that is not fair for somebody who is trying to lose weight. They don't understand that actually that's already factored in to the calculations that have been done. You don't eat them back. You just go with what's going on and you keep it very, very, very simple. Don't go calculating your food. It's not a budget. It's not a budget like that. It certainly is in terms of overall, but you cannot chase your tail burning things off and expecting to do well. It's probably better to, if you have a craving for it or if it's something that you want, it's better to factor it in, not as a burn off, just something as something that you've eaten that day, and then move on. Don't think about it again. That's how you will have long-term success, and build as much muscle as you can. So if you have eaten something that you don't think is good, or, you know, that sort of a thing, get some weights into you. Don't be doing the things like, I'm going to say burpees, things like that. Don't be doing those things to compensate. Actually go and lift some heavy shit. I think that's the first time I've sworn. Lift some heavy stuff. Put it into your muscles and use it. And I can tell you, you will have the best physique you've ever had in your life if you just listen to that advice. Please do not try and burn off things that you consume. Don't exercise for that reason. Do your cardio as in, you know, if you like riding a bike, if you like running, do it because you love it, not as punishment. And I promise you will be successful.
I like that. Can I come out of the corner now, Nick?
Yes.
No, yes. I like it. I like the passion about this topic, because I think it's totally, totally fair where some of these posters or media that appear around, you know, Easter, Christmas, or whatever you see, maybe they're trying to pass on the message that, hey, you know, if you consume this hamburger, that equals the same as, you know, running for an hour, right? Okay. And then it might help individuals to make a more informed decision, being like, okay, should I eat this hamburger and then sit on the couch? Or if I am going to go for a run for an hour, like, could I eat that hamburger? Okay. Sure. I half agree with that kind of idea, but I'm with you where, it can be misleading, especially when that pure transactional equation isn't quite set in a straight line. Like if you said that this hamburger was 1,000 calories, chances are it's not 1,000 calories. Chances are, you know, it's plus or minus 10% of that actual hamburger, plus the way that you consume it, how much you actually digest it, and then the other variables through that consumption process. The absorption number can be a little bit different. You might only absorb, let's say, 874 calories out of that 1,000 calories that is usable for expenditure, right? And then when it comes to actually the energy output, who's to say that, you know, Nick, you running for an hour is the same energy expenditure as me running for an hour? So a little bit misleading as a pure transaction. Remember that we probably, it's a less successful strategy to try to simply expend the energy that we consume. A more beneficial strategy would be to try to build up the total amount of energy expenditure that we elicit throughout the day through building up our muscle mass, like you said. And we know that through like the metabolism, the breakdown of metabolism, we know that the energy required to maintain our body, we call that the basal metabolic rate, that takes up about 70% of our energy expenditure. Then we have our NEAT, that non-exercise activity thermogenesis, about 15%. Then about 10% that's remaining goes towards that formal exercise that we're doing, such as going for a run, doing cardio, whatever we're doing. And then finally, that 5% at the end would be for the TEF, the thermic effect of food. So when we look at what would make the most significant change to our energy expenditure, doing actual formal exercise plays a very small percentage in all of that. What would be more successful to build up our overall budget would be to build up our muscle mass. In maybe a similar analogy, if you want to in life have more money, you know, there's only so much you can save throughout the day or throughout life before you need to find more ways to get a better income. And that income could be to get another job, or that income could be to have a look at your current job and find ways to earn more at your current job, maybe through upskilling or maybe getting a pay rise, moving up the corporate ladder, whatever it is. So we're getting more of an income. That's a similar process to dieting and exercise. You could try to get multiple jobs, or you know, do multiple forms of cardio and more exercise, or you can focus on what matters most, you know, that maybe that one job, that main earning income, which is strength training, building muscle, and building up your income or your budget through calories that way. So a very interesting topic, Nick.
Muscle is cryptocurrency then.
Well, well, I mean, crypto is a little bit too volatile right now. I think building muscle is kind of like the bonds market, if anybody's financially literate out there, where, you know, it's nice, steady gains over time. You know, you can guarantee it over time. Crypto is like taking a random supplement you buy online and hoping that it does something crazy. Is it a placebo?
Yeah,
maybe. Is it some, you know, something else other than creatine? Maybe. But you're in for a bumpy ride. So if we know what gives us those long-term gains that we can enjoy when we are retired, it's probably something a little bit more stable, like something like the bonds market. I mean, depending on which finance person you're talking about, it's a different conversation, but I think you get the context of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll just quickly say, like, when I used to do triathlon, people used to eat so much, and they would not have sort of the best body composition. And we're talking about body composition here. We're not talking about performance. They would like be awesome at performing, but it's just that your body adapts to that sort of stuff. You know, and it just finds really ways of being quite efficient, and it's not worth trying to barter food. I think we always want to just have as much as we can while being in the best condition as we can. That's what we've got to think of, I think.
I agree. And I do think that following that kind of like transactional idea, maybe eating back calories or burning off calories, may lead to some poor relationships with, you know, diet and exercise, such as that idea of maybe like punishing yourself. Like, you know, if you, you know, deep down believe that, oh, if I eat this burger, I need to run for an hour, and you got into a position where maybe you ate a burger because you were time poor, you were just really hungry, you know, whatever reason, you enjoyed a burger, then that might make you go and punish yourself with an hour of running or an hour of cardio, or, you know, going and doing 1,000 burpees or something crazy, as like a punishment for consuming that food. And, you know, if you really think about it, you can enjoy a hamburger, like you can enjoy, you know, these foods that we often label as bad foods or, you know, poor foods, and still be in really great shape and still be a great performer and an athlete and those things. And, you know, you see it in your experience with marathon and triathlon and other endurance events, maybe the foods that those individuals were choosing to consume. Okay. I saw it recently in powerlifting, the foods that those athletes chose to consume. Okay. Which might open your eyes about, you know, what is good, what is bad. And, you know, should you be beating yourself up if you consume that food is a big question.
Correct.
Nick, I want to talk about my, I'm going to have to call it the final segment in my hypertrophy tip, little mini series of this little section of the podcast, Nick. So we're up to hypertrophy tip number 5, where I'm going to talk about positional and regional hypertrophy. Ooh, okay. So again, these aren't in any particular order. We've got 5 tips so far for hypertrophy across the last 5 challenge weekly shows. So tip number 1 was stretch mediated hypertrophy. Tip number 2 was understanding overload. Tip number 3 is maximizing the mind-muscle connection. Tip number 4, we spoke about matching resistance and strength profiles. And now tip number 5, we're going to be talking about positional and regional hypertrophy. And I want to start with a fun little story about what happened to me in the gym last week. Okay, so I was at a commercial gym. I was enjoying a hack squat. And I was enjoying a juicy quad pump where I was filling up my shorts. Okay. So I was filling out my shorts with a juicy quad pump from the hack squat. And I had a bro, and I love bros at the gym. I had a bro come up to me and he's like, bro, how many more sets do you have? And I was like, oh, you know, just maybe another two. I'm like, would you like to work in? He goes, yeah, man. Yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. So I then proceed to have a very quick conversation with the guy where, just in context, this fellow, he was wearing work boots while training. He was wearing footy shorts while training, and in the nicest possible way, he was yet to fill out those footy shorts. Okay. That's all I'm going to say about that. So he's talked to me about his program. He's doing, you know, a 5x5, a strong list type program. Okay, awesome, man. That's really great. Good on you. And he's like, oh, is that all you're lifting? I'm like, oh yeah. Like I'm cool with this. You know, I've got 60 kilos on the squat and the hack squat, but that's fine for me. He's like, oh, surely you'd be lifting up to like, you know, 100 or more. I was like, oh, no, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it. He's like, oh, well, I'm going to be lifting 100 today. I'm like, cool. All right. That's fine. No dramas, dude. Anyway. He proceeds to warm up. I do a set, and once I complete the set, he goes, bro, you should really put your feet up higher and wider so that you can really focus on the outer quad. And I kind of looked at him and I didn't really know what to say. You know, I haven't really received a little bit of like unsolicited training advice from somebody in quite some time. And, you know, I kind of said, thank you. And watched him complete his set and then completed my set how I was normally completing it. Okay. And how does this story match with, you know, what I'm talking about today? Not to talk down to this fellow who was trying to offer some advice, but what he was talking about to me was this concept of positional hypertrophy, okay, where we may be able to bias certain fibers of muscle. For him, he was suggesting the outer quadricep, or maybe that vastus lateralis, the outer quadricep, by placing my feet up higher and wider on the pad panel thing. And I was a little bit skeptical because, you know, with the quadriceps, you know, the way the muscles are fibered, you know, that's a little bit of nonsense. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And positional hypertrophy, the main concept would be to train in a certain way or certain handholds, certain angles, certain positions that we can bias certain muscle fibers. And this might be more significant when we're looking at, let's say, the lat fibers. And we spoke a little bit about the lats last week. But when we look at the lats, a really large muscle, and the origin of the lats, you know, we have a few different origins, meaning that the starting point of the lats, you know, we've got like the spine, so the thoracic spine, the lumbar spine, and then onto the hips, the iliac crest, okay? And then the insertion goes into what's called the bicipital groove, which is up into the bicep or our armpit. You know, that's the distribution of that latissimus dorsi, the lats, okay? So the way that they're orientated, if you were to kind of visualize a skeleton, you know, there's some muscle fibers of the lats that start at like maybe the middle of the spine and go towards the armpit. And there's other fibers of the lats that attach onto the hip and go up towards the armpit. So one muscle has fibers that go kind of more horizontally, and then some fibers that go more vertically. So there's lots of fibers of the lats. So positional hypertrophy would be biasing those fibers by different movements. So if you want to bias maybe the iliac portion of the lats, you know, we need to be training more vertically. And if you wanted to bias more of the thoracic portion of the lats, maybe the more horizontal portion of the lats, we need to be biasing more horizontal rows, or bringing that armpit more towards that middle of the spine, okay? So this is all well and nice, but for positional hypertrophy to be relevant, we need to have muscle mass first. Okay, so for many of us, the beginner, the intermediate, even into the early advanced lifter, positional hypertrophy is not important. Okay, so if you are going to a gym like me and you have a bro come up to you saying that you need to put your feet here and there to bias certain fibers of muscles, and maybe, you know, you've just joined a gym or you've been training for 6 months, 12 months, maybe not a big issue for yourself. Okay. Positional hypertrophy. Now, where does regional hypertrophy come into this? So regional hypertrophy is a concept where we build more muscle mass when we introduce different exercises. Okay. So an interesting study, there was two studies. One looked at the quadricep, one looked at the tricep, and it was, we compared, it was something like 8 sets of squats to 4 sets of squats and 4 sets of leg extensions. Okay, so same volume of quadriceps. And what the study suggested was that there was more quadricep growth when we introduced 2 different quad exercises, you know, a squat and a leg extension, to doing the same volume with just 1 exercise. And it was similar with the triceps. And in this version of it, we did, one group had a tricep extension, the other group had, I think it was a close grip bench press, and then the third group had both, right? Similar volume, might've been the same, maybe 8 sets each group. First group did 8 sets of tricep extension, second group did 8 sets of maybe a close grip bench press, and then the third group did 4 sets of that close grip, 4 sets of that tricep extension. And again, what they found in this study was that there was more tricep growth in that group that did those 2 exercises. Okay, so we start to kind of build this picture of, well, positional hypertrophy is a thing where we can target different muscle fibers. Regional hypertrophy is a thing where if we introduce different exercises to that muscle, you know, we get more muscle growth. So therefore, do we need to train and complete lots of different exercises to hit that muscle? And this might be a similar quote that you might have heard, maybe those old school bodybuilders, the golden era, maybe in pumping iron, where, you know, you've got to hit the muscle from all different angles. You know, you've got to shock the muscle, you know, you've got to train the muscle in all the different fibers. Okay, I'm not too sure about that, because if we introduce lots of different training variables, we never actually get a solid stimulus where we actually grow. Okay, so here's the deal. Firstly, if you want to introduce any positional hypertrophy or really trying to target different fibers or muscle groups, first thing is you actually need some muscle. If you want to target different heads of your quadricep, which I don't think you can other than you know, that rectus femoris in one group, and then the 3 other heads of the quadricep, the medialis, into the lateralis, and the intermedius. They're the 2 kind of groups with the quadricep training. More prominent around other heads of muscles, such as maybe the pec fibers, the shoulders, the back, and such. We need to have some muscle there first. So it's not relevant for that beginner to intermediate. When it comes to regional hypertrophy, we do want to introduce some exercises that train the muscle group from different angles, but I would suggest that you limit it. So when you are going to go train your chest in a gym, you don't need to do every single chest exercise that you could possibly think of, because you need to stimulate every single fiber of the chest. What I would recommend, which is my main tip here, is that to train and stimulate a muscle group significantly and effectively, it's best to introduce at least 2 different exercises that hits that muscle group, and then to change those exercises each mesocycle. Okay, so for example, with your quadriceps, if you want to train your quads, there's no point just doing squats and only squats. It would be better to introduce something like squats and then maybe like a split squat. And then every mesocycle, meaning every like 4 to 6 weeks of training, add some variation and slightly change that exercise. So instead of maybe a back squat, you do a front squat. Instead of maybe a split squat, you do a lunge. Or if you have access to other types of bits of equipment, maybe you modify it slightly. So instead of a squat, you do a hack squat. Instead of a split squat, you do like a leg extension. So adding that slight variation over mesocycles would lead to more significant muscle growth than to try to do A, all the exercises you possibly could for that muscle group, or B, to change the exercise every single week, which will just lead to you kind of like throwing stuff at the wall and hoping something sticks. So the main takeaway, don't give unsolicited advice to people in the gym, and, you know, dabble in some positional hypertrophy concepts. There are some quite popular social media influencers out there that are all about the positional hypertrophy and what angle and everything to train your muscles effectively. But that might not be significant if you are beginner, intermediate, even like that early advanced trainer. You need to have some muscle for it to be worthwhile. And the best strategy is to just choose a couple of variations of exercises that stimulate that muscle, and alternate and cycle through those exercises every couple of mesocycles. Nick.
Unsolicited advices.
Oh gosh. You know, I'm gonna be honest. When I was an early gym bro, I was that guy. I was that guy. I was. I'm not going to hide it. I was that guy when I was very first into the gym. And this was actually my school gym. So I was just dabbling in my school gym.
Baby Steve.
Yeah, baby Steve. Right. I was in my school gym and, you know, I just started improving my body composition. And I was one of the gym bros at my school gym. You know, there's only a few of us that were, you know, more diehard in the gym. And whenever we had like the younger kids come in, as in like I was maybe in year 11, year 12, and they would have been like, you know, year 9 or whatever, going to the gym, unsolicited gym bro advice, bang, bang, bang. I was that guy. So we've moved on from that stage, but we've all been there. I think we all want to help individuals, you know, that real Dunning-Kruger effect. We want to help others because we think we know lots of things. But I think over time you realize more and more that you don't know things and that it really is goal specific, and there's no one way to achieve something, and there's no point in you know, telling someone that you have to do it this certain way or you won't, you know, grow your quads, grow your back, because I guarantee people have grown big quads and big backs and big shoulders through a range of different ways.
Definitely. I agree. I love it. And I hope that he's listening somehow. Maybe well, you should send him this.
Look, if he is listening, my advice to you is go a little bit deeper in that hack squat. Bring your feet maybe a little bit closer together, a little bit lower, go deeper, add a pause at the bottom, feel the stretch at the bottom. Understand that stretch-mediated hypertrophy. Don't limit yourself to just going 5x5. Maybe introduce a rep range because we're understanding overload. We want to focus on that mind-muscle connection. So we want to like focus on that control as you lower, right? Feel that stretch and then come up nice and strong. And then with that hack squat, hey, you've matched the resistance curve and the strength profile with a hack squat. So congratulations, you nailed one of my tips. But that's what I'd say to that fellow, but that's not unsolicited advice to him.
I hope that you guys get to train together as well sometime. That would be really sweet. I like it.
I'm sure I would.
Yes.
Nick, let's move on to some questions for the week. Okay. Mm-hmm. First question here comes in. I eat clean every day, but I still can't lose weight. What am I doing wrong?
Ooh, well, may I please give my unsolicited advices? Actually, it's solicited, really, isn't it? I just want to say advices again. Okay, can I use the acai bowl as an example? I reckon it's the best example of clean eating I can think of. No offense to acai bowls, but acai bowls are crazy. Like, what is in an acai bowl? Everything uniquely, or like on its own, is like probably the healthiest stuff you could ever chuck into your body, quote unquote, like all the micronutrients, you know, beautiful, like I think there's chia seeds, I think there's you know, gorgeous blueberries, possibly some nuts, something else that pads it out. It must be something thick. I don't know.
I think it's like mixed with like some avocado and some crazy
stuff.
Yeah,
avocado, right? Chuck that in there. And, you know, protein. It's the most, probably a week's worth of deliciousness in one bowl. Now you go out and you have the option of two eggs with some sourdough and perhaps like a little half a piece of avocado, or you have the choice of an acai bowl and you think, well, there's bread there. I can't possibly eat that bread. That's not good. You know, we've heard that. But you look at the caloric value over all of that, and the acai bowl will probably be, I'm just guessing, but probably like maybe 800 or 900 calories, whereas the toasted stuff would be maybe 4, you know, with the eggs as well. So we're kind of looking at that idea of it's quote unquote, you would say clean, because it's all gorgeous. It's from nature. It's stunning. It's like a lot of these concoctions, like cacao and all those things that make those gorgeous chocolate things, where you may as well just have a Snickers bar. Now, no offense to the beautiful people that make all these gorgeous recipes, but if you look at the caloric value, they're often quite loaded, because they often have your honeys and things like that that are quite heavy on the calories. So sometimes it's just worth looking at sort of those hidden calories, that just because someone tells you something is healthy, it doesn't mean that you can't actually eat too much of it. I mean, too much for what your needs are. There's no such thing as too much or not enough. But even, it's hard, but even say something like broccoli, you may even just say you overconsumed broccoli and it was quote unquote healthy, but it's more calories than what you need. then you will probably not lose weight, or you'll probably end up gaining some if you're in a surplus. It's pretty hard with broccoli, which is why it's a volume food, which is why we recommend to have it, because it's something that can fills you up, you know, fairly well without being massive. But these other things, they don't actually necessarily fill you up. With an acai bowl, I could neck an acai bowl in a minute and then want to still have the eggs. So that's where we kind of run into a bit of trouble. I don't find those products that or those concoctions terribly filling. So, yeah, it's just about having a real look at what's going on, tracking everything. It doesn't matter if it's healthy or not. It's great if you're going with the health. That's brilliant. Then the next step is to actually track each bite that you eat. So even though I was saying before, you can't, it's not a transaction, but with this, you could do this and do zero exercise. I'm not recommending that, but you could do this, track everything and get yourself into that deficit and not even worry about your burpees and still lose weight as long as you are honest with yourself. So if you bite it, write it.
If you bite it, write it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think it was like
we might put it on our t-shirts.
If you bite it, write it.
Yeah.
I think there's like a little in-joke in the fitness industry whenever we hear about like eating clean or clean eating, those types of things. We kind of all collectively go, oh, yeah, like I'm glad you wash your food before you eat it, right? Yeah. Where, you know, eating clean eating, it's a very loose like definition. I think we all kind of like know what it means or what they're implying, but it's loose definition. And here's another story, if you would entertain my stories today, Nick.
I like your stories. Once upon a time,
I was going to a buddy's house and he was having a little dinner party. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was on a Tuesday and it was Taco Tuesday.
Oh.
Taco Tuesday, right? Taco mm-hmm. Tuesday. And I got there a little early. It was my close buddy. And he was there preparing like a minced beef. Okay. Mm-hmm. And as he's getting the frying pan ready, he grabs the olive oil and douses it all through the fry pan. I was like, whoa, man, like, you know, ease up on the olive oil. He's like, oh, no, it's fine, bro. I'm eating clean. I was like, okay. He's like, yeah, olive oil, it's clean. I was like, oh, okay. Like, you put like, you know, an Italian serve of olive oil here. We're cooking Mexican. Come on, man. Mm-hmm. So I think the big challenge when an individual chooses to eat clean, which can lead to, you know, a reduction in calorie intakes. You know, if you start to think, okay, what's clean? Maybe I'm having maybe more quote natural foods, whatever that means, or maybe trying to consume more fruits and vegetables and not trying to consume processed foods or like highly hypercaloric foods. Great. You know, this can be a great strategy to reduce our overall caloric intake. The problem that we face is often around our fat intake. So, you know, with the acai bowl, some problems that we face is, you know, large intakes of like nuts, dried fruits, avocados, olive oil, right? Some of these foods are marketed as clean foods, healthy foods, where, okay, if you're having if you're having these conversations about health, okay, you know, maybe it might be good for your health. But if we're talking about weight loss, body composition changes, it really is kind of about managing our calorie intake. And some of these foods that are labeled as clean or healthy or organic or, you know, whatever, natural nature foods can be really high in calories. And just because you choose to eat those foods, it might mean that you are in a calorie surplus and gain weight. And it's the same conversation with some people who choose to go vegan or plant-based for weight loss purposes. Oh, I'm going plant-based. So then they go and choose to eat like a Snickers bar because they're like, oh yeah, because that's you know, it's plant-based. And it's like, well, it's really high calories, right? Sure, it is, you know, just chocolate and nuts, and maybe it's not vegan, right? Maybe that was a really poor example. But sometimes people are going to go through this clean dieting phase where, if anything, they start to consume more calories and start gaining weight because they're, you know, like my buddy, dousing the fry pan with olive oil because they're trying to eat clean, even though we're about to go eat tacos.
Yeah, my dad, I love my dad, but because he's Italian, it's like Mediterranean diet, but yeah, like goes through a bottle of olive oil a week and then Parmesan cheese and all sorts of things like that. So when he goes to the doctor for his health, he's like, I eat Mediterranean. And they're like, oh, that's fantastic. But they never delve deeper and go, well, what do you eat? And it's like, there are those extras.
Yeah.
But because my dad's cute and sweet, I don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, it's the same conversation with those fellows who follow like keto diets. Nothing wrong with keto diets. They can be quite successful in a weight loss endeavor. But if you are choosing to have a higher fat intake and you're not measuring how many fats you consume and you're going and putting a stick of butter in your coffee, ooh, you're going to put olive oil in everything and, you know, follow maybe a bit of a Mediterranean style and put Parmesan cheese on everything and really, you know, douse your salad with salad dressing and olive oil because, oh yeah, it's fine. I'm going keto. I'm having low carbs and high fats. You know, you might blow out your total caloric intake by following that process if you are just following that rule of, oh, I have high fats and low carbs with no respect given to the total caloric intake of that. So similar conversation, eating clean, those who choose to go vegan or keto or any type of dieting approach, it really does come down to the overall caloric intake.
Absolutely. And yeah, you've got to measure it.
You do. You really do.
Yeah. And like say, I'll just say one more thing and then we'll move on. But I used to go out with Shane when we were dating. We're not dating anymore, so we don't go out as much, but for breakfast and things. And Shane stayed the same for years. Good old Shane. He's about 98, 100 kilos, 6 foot, whatever. That's him. You know, he could probably lose a bit of weight, but he maintains. He just eats what he wants, basically. I don't know what he does. But I used to always try and be healthy, and there's no way that I was eating less calories than him. He'd have his bacon, eggs, bread, and move on, whereas I'd be like acai bowl and something else, and I'd be eating three times the amount as him, thinking that I was healthier. Just saying. Just be like Shane.
Be like Shane. All right, Nick. All right. Next question here. Do I need to train more for better results? Ooh, interesting question with lots of layers to it. Let's break it down. Okay. So firstly, do I need to train more for better results? Results is probably the big kicker here. It's like, well, what does results mean? And then, you know, do I need to train more? We don't know what your training is like now. Well, first thing I'd say is that if your goal is to build muscle and we're measuring training by the total volume, we do need to increase volume to a certain threshold for better results before we start experiencing diminishing returns, okay? Same analogy that we've experienced with this podcast here, where if we're going to go study something, okay, if we're going to go study a new language, so let's say Coach Steve's going to learn Italian from Coach Nick, okay? If I study more, I will get better results to a certain tipping point, to a certain threshold, before more studying leads to diminishing returns. And maybe an example would be if I, you know, start staying up really late, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, 2 a.m, 3 a.m, and I start sacrificing my sleep, you know, me studying more and more won't lead to better results. It might be better for me to step away from, you know, studying Italian, go to sleep, come back, and that would be better results. So same in training, you know, you probably reach a tipping point where, let's say if you train for maybe put a number on it, 1 hour, you train for an hour in a gym, that might be your threshold. But if you then choose to stay in the gym for another half an hour, so that's 90 minutes or 2 hours in a gym, that extra bit at the end might not be better. If anything, that might be diminishing returns. You know, you might be training so much that it takes you so long to recover. For example, if you do a really, 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 really with multiple really hard set, a hard leg session, and you completely destroy your quads, your hamstrings, your glutes, your calves, and you can't walk for a week, you might stimulate some hypertrophy, but you know it interferes with your future training. You might have been training so hard that it actually limits how much growth can occur because you've actually caused lots of tissue damage. So to answer this question, it's yes, to a certain point. So yes, we need to train more to a certain point for better results. That point isn't clearly defined because we can all withstand our own training levels. So if I was maybe 21 again, you know, I'm almost 30 now. If I was 21 and I didn't have responsibilities and I didn't have a child and I was single and I was, you know, eating whatever I wanted, sleep whatever I wanted, different lifestyle, I could train maybe 7 days a week, you know, 90 minute sessions and, you know, train really hard and really awesomely. Now, I can't do that. You know, my sleep is a little bit restricted with dad life. And, you know, I have jobs, I have commitments, I have responsibilities now. I've got a mortgage to pay. I've got all these things. So I've got other stresses in my life. So I can't train like I was when I was, you know, 21, right? Which didn't seem too long ago. Expand that further. If you were a little bit older, you know, into your 30s, 40s, 50s, you've got other responsibilities, you might not be able to train to the same level. So it's very poorly defined. What is the maximum? What is the threshold? What is the tipping point for all of us? Where if we train more, it leads to diminishing returns. What I would say is if you are looking for the maximum recoverable volume, so how much possibly could you do the maximum, we would need to start to measure your overall performance. So if your performance starts diminishing over time, you are probably doing too much. So we need to find this nice tipping point where we are writing things down, we're tracking our journey, we're tracking our progress, and we go, okay, if I did 10 sets of quad work next week, am I quad so butchered that I can't do 10 sets to the same level? Or if I did 12 sets, does that lead to a diminishing return? If I did 14 sets, is that a diminishing return? What about the total volume? Can you compare week to week? Because every week is the same about the total stresses that we have in life and all the other things going on. Difficult to measure. So for most of us, it's probably wise to maybe go a little bit more conservative rather than trying to push for what is my possible maximum for that particular week. We're trying to be a little bit conservative, maybe training with a few reps in the tank and a few sets in the tank, so we're not completely destroying ourselves every session, trying to do more, because sometimes more doesn't always lead to better results because of that diminishing return effect.
Definitely. I spent my whole 20s probably thinking more. Mm-hmm. Now I think, what's the least I can do to get some good results?
That's right.
Like a lazy ass, but not really. Like a smart ass.
Smart ass, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe similar analogy again. Oh, my analogies today.
I know.
Kind of like what we're talking about. When we're talking about, you know, like the crypto market as an example. If you were wanting to invest money for your retirement, you have a few options. You could try to go for like those emerging markets or like those kind of get rich quick volatile areas like crypto. Great, you know, you might be successful, you might not be. Or you can go for the tried and true, you know, slow gains over time, and maybe, you know, investing in an index fund. You know, that's what our superannuation is through. You know, maybe looking at those kind of S&P 500 items, and, you know, maybe go through Vanguard or whatever it is. So those types of gains, maybe, you know, like that 5-10% per year might be better long term than trying to, you know, like double your money in a week, right? You know, might as well just go to the casino. Similar kind of concepts. You know, if you are trying to look for the minimum effective dose, okay, every week I'm doing the bare minimum to see progress, maybe just slightly above that bare minimum. Those long term gains would compound better than trying to find the maximum. What's the most, what's the best results I could possibly do for any given time?
Yeah.
Nick, next question here. Why should I track my step counts? Is it really that important?
Ooh. Okay. Well, I've been chatting to quite a few very successful challengers in the last week or so while we've been doing our podcasts. And quite a few of them have said this time that when they started to pay attention to steps, and mind you, these are people that are actually winning the challenge, the game changed for them. So that's a clue. Success leaves clues. That's a clue that steps are fairly important. Now, why are steps important? Well, I think the fact is that a lot of us don't move a lot. You know, you and I are sitting here right now doing this podcast. We like training, but, you know, I mean, we take our dogs for a walk, things like that. But I think you and I both have to make an effort to get out and do our steps and things like that. Because otherwise you end up being, even though you might train hard, you can be in the sort of the group that has very low activity. And that probably isn't very conducive to changing your body composition in a weight loss way, you know, in that kind of a way. You need to actually get moving. So because our NEAT isn't necessary, I'm just guessing for you as well. You know, we go on our walks when we're at work and stuff like that. Our generally like our our NEET isn't huge, massive, so we have to find a way to get ourselves out there. So they're important, so you actually end up basically moving. 10,000 steps is about just over an hour and a bit, depends on who you are and what your stride is like. And that's just basically, I mean, look, it was set up by, I think, the Fitbit company or one of those companies. It's just a benchmark, but it's just to get you moving. It actually is also a very good way to, I'm not going to say burn calories, just to get out there and get things going that isn't a huge impact, not like doing a big bike ride where you get exhausted and you might overeat and eat it back. It's actually just a way to get yourself moving, to get your required amount of exercise, not just for body composition, but also just to be healthy in general. So I would say it's important when you are looking to lose weight. It's one of those factors that will really be a game changer. And also it's good for overall health.
I completely agree. Do you want to hear another super summary of some research around steps, Nick?
Yes, why not?
I vaguely remember reading it was like a systematic review of step data, and it was something like every 1,000 steps over 3,000 steps a day. So every like step up in thousands steps. Yeah. So, you know, if you do 3,000 steps versus 4,000 steps versus 5,000 steps, every 1,000 steps, decrease the all-cause mortality rate quite a few percentage points, right? So what that means is that, you know, maybe in that lower threshold, if you're doing 3,000 steps, that's good. That's better than 2,000 steps. But then if you're able to do 1,000 more steps in a day, so maybe that 4,000 steps, maybe that 5,000 steps and beyond, start to significantly decrease your all-cause mortality rate, long term. And that could be from all sorts of things, you know, from cancers, heart attacks, you know, all the other stuff that kind of kills us eventually. But what that kind of suggests to us is that, you know, the more steps that we do, the better it is for our overall health. And that's, you know, different to the conversation we often have, which is around body composition, weight loss. We know that the step count, directly manipulates that NEAT, that non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which makes up that second biggest portion of our energy expenditure. So the more activity we do, and that doesn't need to be like formally walking on a treadmill and counting your steps. That can just be, you know, you wearing a pedometer or a Fitbit or a smartwatch or anything it is. And, you know, you going to work and you realize, oh yeah, I do 12,000 steps a day just from walking around the warehouse at work. Great, like that's awesome. Cool, you tick the box. But if you are someone who maybe you're working from home right now, you get up out of bed, you walk to your kitchen, you walk to your study, you sit at your desk and you're working away, and then you get up and you go back to your kitchen for lunch and you sit on your couch and eat your lunch and then you go back to your computer, and throughout that whole day you barely reach 2,000 steps because you're just at home chilling out. Okay, that can be a major factor to your one, weight gain, two, poor like energy levels, and three, maybe, you know, poor like health biomarkers. You know, you may be starting to deteriorate in health because you're just simply not physically active. If I was to give a range, right, because, you know, 10,000 is a nice round number. If I was to give a range, I would suggest individuals to aim between maybe 5 and 15,000 steps. If you're below 5,000 steps, you really need to put in some effort to get those steps up above 5,000. And if you're doing more than 15,000 steps a day, you're kind of in that higher physical activity level where that might be interfering with, you know, strength training endeavors. So if your goal is weight loss, aim for that 5 to 15,000 steps. If you're doing more than 15,000 steps, sometimes it's inevitable because you're doing life, you know, you've got to go to work, you got to do the things, you got to chase after the kids, all the stuff. But if you are trying to do more than 15,000 steps on purpose, all right, I'm trying to do 18,000 steps a day because that leads to more weight loss. Similar to my answer about training more, does it lead to better results? That might lead to diminishing returns. And that's probably that round number.
Look at this. I'll show you. I don't know if you can see. Oh, you can't see. Yes. Look, I'm pretty much exactly what you said, somewhere between the 5 and 15.
So far, Nick, you know, it's about midday today.
I can sit down then.
You can sit down for the rest of the day, yeah.
Yes, but yes, you see, I did go through a phase, Coach Steve, where I was trying to do, over lockdown, I got a little bit bored with everything. I was trying to do about 20,000 a day, and it took me so long. And also I was seeing diminishing returns. I wasn't, nothing was really happening. You know, my training wasn't My training's always okay, but obviously there's more I can do. Even if I'm squatting really well or deadlifting really well or whatever I'm doing, I could probably do better if I wasn't doing the 20,000 steps. So I figured that out finally, and that's me who's bossing everyone else around.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It happens. So for me, diminishing returns is definitely, it starts to, my body just adapts very quickly, and it's like 20,000 was not doing anything, and it's like, where do you go from there?
Yeah. I think a better strategy would be to look at like the weekly step count. Mm-hmm. So instead of like a daily step count of, let's say, 10,000 steps or, you know, between 5 and 15,000 steps, maybe aiming for something more weekly as a weekly goal, because, you know, some days we are of lower step count for whatever reason. Some days we are of higher step count for whatever reason. And that's okay, because life is life. So if you focus maybe on a weekly step count of something like, you know, 50 to 100,000 steps per week, right? That averages out to what's the quick math? Maybe, you know, between 7 and 12 or 13,000 steps a day, you know, very close, but they're two nice round numbers between 50 and 100,000 steps.
I want to show you my yearly data.
Yeah.
Can you see 3 million? Can you see?
Yeah, 3,218,593 steps. Is that in the past 12 months or... Yeah, it wouldn't be just...
25th of May, 2021. But you love data.
I do. How good is that?
But I've peeled it, as you can see. See, I'm not even... Oh, my God, it's so exciting because I'm not even lying. You can see it all. So it's exactly what I said. But see how it's tapered down a little bit?
That's right.
And my body composition has improved right exactly then. But this is like nitty-gritty stuff that, like, if you're going for that kind of physique stuff at the... Not just general health.
The higher end stuff, yeah.
Yeah, just if everything was taken away and the barbells were taken away, and it would be so sad, it would be terrible. But, you know, like walking is brilliant.
Oh,
walking
yeah.
is lovely. Walking's good for your health. It's good for your mental health. That you get to see people, you get to take your kids out, your dog, everything. So I recommend 5 out of 5.
10 out of 10. Come on, Nick. No, it's 5 out of 5.
All right. Okay.
Unless it's like a 5-star or 10 out of 10.
Well, 5-star, but 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10. Love it.
Yeah.
Nick, final question here. Should a beginner focus on strength or hypertrophy first? Ooh.
Yeah, I knew like this question. Like this one, I thought you'd love when I saw it.
Yeah, okay. So look, let's break it down. I think the person who wrote this, I like that they've highlighted that, you know, defining a beginner, maybe it's for themselves, maybe they're coaching someone, you know, whatever it is. But let's use the sake of a beginner here, someone who's brand new to training, or someone who, you know, might be coming back to training after some time off for whatever reason, maybe life got in the way, they got injured, you know, whatever it is. So a beginner would be someone who hasn't really trained in the past 12 months, and they're still in their maybe like first 6 to 12 months of returning to training. Okay. So should they focus on strength or hypertrophy first? The answer here is that both will happen, you know, together, right? Talking about strength, no matter what you do, if you are a beginner and you walk into a gym and even just add the weight plates to a barbell to train, you will start getting muscle and getting strength. So that's the nice thing about if you are coming from, you know, let's say the stereotypical couch potato, and you're going to a gym and you're doing any sort of resistance training, you will start building strength. Okay, so that's the first thing. Strength and hypertrophy occur when we are training above what our current norm is. So if you're normally sitting on the couch, you getting off the couch and going to the gym is going to be stimulating. Okay, so that's the first thing that we need to identify. Strength gains happen rapidly in the first 6 to 12 weeks of training. Okay. So that's why a true beginner, when they go to the gym, each time they train, they could probably add a little bit more to the bar or to the machine, wherever it is, every single week, because they get those beginner gains, those strength gains. It's a little bit addictive. Okay. So we get that nice dopamine fix. Oh yeah, week one, I only put the little pin at number one. And now week two, I put the pin at number two. And week three, I put the pin at number three. And that's can be a little bit misleading, because we think, oh, well, if each week I can add another, like, you know, stack to it, that means that I could be like, you know, Ronnie Coleman in a year. Okay, maybe not. It's not that linear. It's not that straight line. Okay. So that's the first thing, that strength happens very rapidly in that first 6 to 12 weeks. And that's mainly through the nervous system adapting to that new stimulus. Okay, so that's mainly through nerves, all right? Next is about hypertrophy. We see very quick and rapid hypertrophy gains, or visibly bigger muscles, in again that 6 to 12 week mark when we start training, no matter what we do, because of one, the changes in our nervous system lead to more glycogen stores in the muscle, okay? So that muscle starts to look visibly bigger in that first 6 to 12 weeks. But true hypertrophy occurs usually beyond that. So kind of closer to that, you know, 8 week plus mark. So a little bit of a crossover. So 6 to 12 weeks, we start to get some significant visible muscle growth because we go, wow, you know, those muscles look bigger, awesome. But true hypertrophy occurs kind of beyond that 8 weeks, where, you know, if we were to kind of pull your muscle out and measure it and through a biopsy, we could start saying, yeah, muscle is definitely growing here. So what should you focus on first? Well, you are probably in that same position, like in my coach's corner tip, where I was talking about positional hypertrophy. Right now, as a beginner, you may not need to even worry about focusing on strength or hypertrophy, and just focusing on a good, repeatable, and safe technique while you're completing that exercise, and starting to learn different techniques, such as if you're learning how to squat, you're learning how to bicep curl, you're learning how to overhead press. And before you say, oh yeah, those are easy, you know, I can do those, I've been training for well over 10, closer to 15 years, a big portion of my life. And every time I go to the gym, I'm looking for ways to get better at those techniques. So just like any sort of athlete that you look at or watch or have seen on TV or on your phone or your computer, those individuals go through years and years of learning how to shoot hoops, learning how to kick the footy, learn how to hit the tennis ball. And it's the same thing with training. Even though it might look like you're doing that technique, you can always get better. And that's part of that, you know, beginner to intermediate to advanced progression. So that'll be the main thing we focus on, just focusing on, you know, getting a repeatable technique. That's the main one, where it's repeatable and safe so that you can complete that technique over and over again. It looks like a piston going up and down when you complete that technique, and then the strength and hypertrophy will come along. Once we no longer see that week to week gain, where no longer you can, you know, add another little pin on the stack, that's when you start to transition into that intermediate life where, you know, your gains are no longer linear. That's when you may need to implement different loading strategies where maybe having periods of higher training, periods of lower training, so that your body can continue to grow. And that becomes a lifelong journey as we transition to that intermediate. And hopefully one day we transition into that advanced athlete, where we start looking at those, you know, 1% is nitty gritty and long-term periodization. But the main takeaway is, probably not worth focusing on strength or hypertrophy first, because both of them are so intertwined. As a beginner, you'll get both by just simply getting off the couch and lifting some weights.
Do you wish you were a beginner again sometimes?
Oh yeah. I wish I can get those beginner gains every day. And it's interesting though, because, you know, when you add some variety into your training, like if you have a new stimulus, or maybe you introduce a new priority with your training, you do kind of get those little beginner gains again, because you get this new stimulus. But it's just like a party scene. Here's my final analogy of the day. So just like your party scene, where maybe you start to party and, you know, you're drinking alcohol, and then, you know, you want the next hit, so you look for this first guy that sells you something on the dance floor, and you need your next hit. A little bit similar to training, where, you know, you start off with that gateway, and then you start to dabble in different things, and, you know, you just try to find that next stimulus that gives you kind of those beginner gains again. So I don't know how ethical that last analogy was today, but we got there, Nick. We got there.
We should do a little podcast one day on what we would do differently if we could begin again.
What we could do differently if we could begin again. I like that. Maybe this is a story for life, where, you know, I am where I am today because of all the mistakes I made in the past. So if I didn't do all those things, I wouldn't be the type of trainee that I am now. So if anything, I respect all those mistakes and errors and things that I made in the past, and that is part of who I am. So if I was to do it again, I would probably do it the exact same way, because I am happy where I am right now.
That's so nice. You're so nice.
A little bit of philosophy for you.
I wouldn't. I'd change everything. I'm a little bit older, so you know, like that's where that comes into in handy. You realize that you would change everything.
Well, look, Nick, let's wrap it up there for episode number 66, where we could be making deals with the devil to rewind the clock so that we can get our beginner gains once again. Mm-hmm. Nick, if you enjoyed this episode, Nick, you can go listen to the other 65 episodes. It would take you maybe a week and a half of full-time work to listen to Coach Steve and Coach Nick talking about everything fitness and health. And we're going to catch you next week in episode number 67.
Thank you. See you, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. If you like the show, share it with a friend.
Or leave us a review on iTunes to spread the good word. See you next time.